All right, welcome everybody. Welcome to the Roller Out the Barrel podcast. This is the first of our series of phone interviews that we'll be releasing every other week, as opposed to the every other week live interviews that we've already started. So this is episode 3 or 2B, depends on how you look at it. I had that funky little diehard thing I did. And coming to the show via the telephone wires from the East Coast, from the Connecticut Bulldogs, it is Chuck Cicerello. Am I saying your last name right, Chuck?
That's a negative.
I figured so.
It's pronounced Chicarello.
Chicarello. Now, since you're from the East Coast, do I have to say it like a mobster, like Chicarello?
Extra point.
Sure. Yes. Now your baseball moniker is Uncle Charlie. Is that correct?
That's one of the things that people have said over the years. There are a few others. I don't mind that. It's all right.
What would you say is the main one that people call you that you can say?
Well, it's not very flattering, but I played in Massachusetts many moons ago. I have the nickname Champagne, which kind of stuck with the Whately Pioneers, and that's on its way into Boston with me, and then later on in my career into Connecticut.
Champagne.
It was kind of a funny story. We were getting ready to warm up one morning in Whately, and there was another team that was a modern team warming up on the other field, and they had live music playing. Well, I shouldn't say live music. It was pre-recorded music, but they were playing it live in our vicinity, and there was an old song called Champagne Charlie playing, and everyone started dancing around and kicking their heels up and pointing and laughing at me. And then, you know, from that day on, I was Champagne Charlie for a while.
You know, I don't think that's a bad name. I actually kind of like it.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have the best connotation in the world. You know, if I were, you know, we're in the workplace and someone said, hey, here comes Champagne, you know, it might be tough to take a sick day, you know, under those circumstances.
Sure. So let's get right into this. The way I want to do this is I want to talk about your life in baseball from your very earliest memory to where you are today. And when we get to today, I definitely want to talk about the Connecticut Vintage Baseball Association and that in the league you have going on out there. It's not really a league, right? It's more of an association.
It's a consortium where we share ideas about historical accuracy. We schedule smartly between all six teams so that we can share resources, share players, and not really conflict with each other. In a perfect world, we would never play at the same time. It does happen just because that's the nature of the beast. But, you know, it's good in that sense that we give our fans, you know, the location where to find Connecticut baseball any weekend of the summertime, really.
Yeah, awesome. We're just starting a league, actually an association over here in the Midwest. It'll be our first season. So we actually looked to areas like yours and Tennessee's, and there's a couple more to try to get off on the right foot, and then we'll perfect it as we go along, I would assume.
It's a fairly big undertaking, but, you know, all the leaders in Connecticut all have various professional skills, just like any other region, I'd assume. So that, you know, we help one another. You know, some folks are good with internet and you know, multimedia. Some people make really nice posters. Some people just are really good at outreach. So we tend to see a lot of different teams under our model.
Sure. Okay, Chuck, let's go from your very first memories of baseball and take it all the way up to today.
Well, I mean, my first memory of baseball was game 6 of the 1986 World Series. I watched that at home on the square TV, like they were back in the day with, you know, probably 2 channels of audio. Remember, my dad was very upset, as you can imagine, as a Red Sox fan. I was 7 years old at the time, and I learned all sorts of new colorful language.
How many words were said during the Buckner situation?
My dad had a very unique way of expressing his frustration. And, you know, I had an early education on things that little Bush probably shouldn't say or hear. But, you know, that was the way it went. You know, baseball has a funny way of being cruel at times, and that was certainly not a warm memory for Red Sox Nation, but it is my first sports story. From there, you know, growing up north of Boston, my dad would take us to Fenway Park. We'd sit in the cheap seats, but we were there. You know, we went and saw a lot of baseball together. That went on for many years until I, you know, became a high schooler. Had other interests at the time, maybe rather than watching baseball with my dad, as the story goes. But as it would turn out, I would be rekindled in my love for baseball when I took the job working for the New England Sports Network at the young age of 20. So I stayed there for, 11 years. Saw two world championships in 04 and 07. I was part of the Red Sox production in the studio, and that brought me really close to the game. One might even say too close.
So were you able to enjoy it to its fullest, those championships, or did the job kind of take priority at that time?
It's interesting. It's kind of a two-headed beast. Like, you know, when you're working on a project, you know, sometimes into the wee hours of the morning, sometimes all you want is for it to end. So you can go on to sleep and wake up the next day and work the next game. So honestly, you know, myself and my peers, we found ourselves rooting for ourselves more than for the Red Sox at times.
Right, right. So, big. Do you consider yourself a Mets fan or a Red Sox fan?
Well, I'll always be a Red Sox fan, but, you know, nowadays I have a son who's 10 years old, and he's taken a great shine to baseball, which, you know, certainly is very exciting to me, you know, that I don't have to force him to be interested in the thing that I love. So we'll watch baseball now regardless of who's playing, really, as long as it's, you know, professional baseball, whether it's, you know, Major League Baseball, or, you know, we go to minor league games and, you know, watch different levels of baseball on TV. But it's fun. It's something that he genuinely loves, and I'm excited to be able to share it with him, to the extent that he's actually taken the field with us on a few occasions to play vintage baseball.
Oh, that's very good. I can't wait to get into that. Let's go back to when you were a kid and talk about any organized baseball that you played.
Very little. I played clinic. Yeah, I think it was coach pitch. I probably played a year of T-ball. But really found my sports identity through football and outdoor track. I would play to stay in shape for the football season. But that really took over my life in terms of sports playing. I didn't start playing organized baseball until I was 30. And that happened to be vintage baseball about 10 years ago.
Oh, so you didn't – so virtually no baseball, but
– very little.
But you would say that you were – oh, go ahead.
I mean, I was certainly very aware of the game and loved it deeply, but I didn't play organized baseball because that was a sport you could get cut from, you know, whereas with football, if you're not the most talented player, they put you on the scout team. You know, so there was maybe a little bit of that, maybe a little bit of fear that, you know, the knowledge, the reality of the fact that I wasn't a very talented baseball player as a youth. And, you know, I think young people seek acceptance and are fragile and vulnerable. And I don't think I wanted to be in a situation where I would be cut from the team.
So you get to 30 years old, and what comes first, the opportunity to play vintage baseball or the history?
For me, it was, kind of like a hostage crisis in a lot of ways. I was a television director at this point in my career, and the young man behind me on the graphics machine had a baseball team in Rhode Island. And he said to me, "I'm going to do my best Patrick impression, and those people who know him will appreciate this." He said, "Charlie, you're going to play barehanded baseball." And I turned around and I said, you're out of here. Sleep in mind, I'm not going to play barehanded baseball. That's insane. And he said to me very clearly, "I'm going to say it again. You're playing." So I went to his game and played my first game for the only Bill Cadets back in 2009, and I fell in love with it. Culture, guys, camaraderie, the competitiveness, it was there. It really did it for me in ways that I can't really say I expected it to.
So go ahead and go through all of the teams that you have considered yourself a member of, because You started this Connecticut Bulldogs team back in 2018, correct?
That's correct.
So you have probably played a lot of vintage baseball up until that point. What were some of the teams that you played with?
Sure. So I started with the aforementioned Olneyville Cadets, played with them for a couple of years, mostly in 1886. Had some injuries, but never shy away from the club. A few years later, things weren't working out as well, I think, as I hoped. And I wanted to try on some different teams. So I went to the Whately Pioneers in Massachusetts, a team that doesn't play anymore, but they were quite good when they did play. And they gave me a home of sorts in baseball where I played for a couple of years. When they started to come apart a little bit, I went to the Boston Bean Eaters and continued to play 1886. After that, let's see, after the Bean Eaters, it was about the time that I moved to Connecticut. And I started playing for the Wethersfield Red Onion under Jeff Kornhoff. That was great. We played mostly 64. Jeff is a very talented pitcher. He had a great group of players around him. So we played at a fairly high level. Did that for several years. And then wanted to really try to run my own club. I had been on, I don't want to be too harsh, because I know a lot of people probably listen to this, but I felt like at that point in my career, I'd been on some good teams that weren't very fun, and some fun teams that weren't necessarily very good. And I wanted to have the opportunity to try to build my own culture and try to, you know, potentially have the best of both worlds, to have a team that was both fun and good, you know, with an emphasis on historical accuracy, probably a de-emphasis on, you know, the drinking and, you know, the stuff that young teams do sometimes, you know, on or around the field that aren't, you know, necessarily the best reflection of the game and the way that we want to show the fans. So I wanted to start my own team, but I didn't know what to do or how to do it. So I started this Pick 9 called New England Pick 9. And I would select from the many teams in New England to try to field 9 people successfully. So that went on for a few years. And, you know, from there, I really wanted to make my own team and not be reliant on other people's players and rosters. Wanted to play 1886, but kind of having a hard time with my research because, you know, the Hartford Dark Blues, for instance, had stopped playing in 1886. And I just kind of hit a gap in my research where I couldn't quite figure out the next step. And then I was just sitting around thinking about it one night, and it was like a light switch. You know, I thought, well, what about you? So I started to look into that and realized that they, you know, are the oldest baseball team in New England. They started in the early 1860s. I think 64 was their first year as a club. Wanted to do it, called Paul to try to have the uniforms made and start the process of, you know, having a team. And I don't think Paula was comfortable making uniforms without permission. So I said, okay, well, I need to call Yale here and find out, you know, what I can do and what I can't do. So I reached out, and they were very, very confused. They were something to the tune of, I'm sorry, what do you want to do? You guys do what? And it became pretty apparent to me that I think the biggest issue with vintage baseball in terms of the fan base is that a lot of people just don't know we exist.
Correct.
That's a real big hurdle. And the Yale situation was a real eye-opener because they had no idea that this existed. So I directed them to the DBA website as a proof of concept to show that it takes place, you know, across the country and that it's a legitimate undertaking. So we came up with a, I guess what you would call a partial licensing agreement where I can use the logo. I can't sell the logo, which is fine because I don't really need to sell it. I own all the uniforms. I rent them out to the players for free. I loan them out. And I can never use the word Yale in print because that would create, you know, brand confusion, which is understandable. So I said, well, how about if we call it the Connecticut Bulldogs? And I said, well, sure, go for it. So that was good enough for Paula and good enough for us. You know, it was an agreement that I think all parties were comfortable with. So we launched the club and, you know, send them pictures and game accounts, you know, periodically, and they enjoy it and appreciate it. And it's been a very, you know, good relationship in that regard. I don't do things that they dislike, and I get to do the things that we want to do with the club. And it's worked out well in that regard. I'm really glad that I reached out.
So a couple of questions on some of the things that you went over. Would you say that the East Coast in your area is mainly 1886 ball?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, there's a big pocket of 86. You know, there are several teams in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut in play, but I think, you know, the predominant style is the 1864 style.
Will teams play both kinds? Will they? Because that's a pretty big difference in the rules. You know, around here, we're mainly 64 or 67. And to us, that's a big difference. There's teams that just won't play each other. And that's only a three-year time gap. Do you run into a lot of problems with that out there?
I think the biggest problem is satisfying all parties. You know, we try to do as many teams at every date as we can do so that we're not asking our guys to play every weekend. And that through the course of our year, we get to see a lot of teams without necessarily going to all of their home venues. So we'll have our festival dates that are just one day events, but you know, teams will play two or three different games. And the biggest problem with mixing 64 and 86 is just the length of the experience. You know, the average 86 game can take in excess of 3 hours. You know, whereas I'm sure as you guys have found, 64 takes significantly less time, you know, usually about 90 minutes. So that's four and a hook when you think about it. That's a big ask. You know, the guys who love it, the guys who want to do it, they don't complain. You know, we train hard during the winter. We try to take care of our bodies and do the right things because, you know, the reality is that the game is very dangerous, you know, especially with the explosive plays as you get older and your, you know, your bones and joints and ligaments start, you know, becoming more vulnerable. It's really, you know, that much more important that people hydrate, stretch out, just all those things that sometimes as we forget or take for granted, you know, it becomes pretty apparent when you're having a hard time walking around on a Wednesday that maybe you should have taken your warm up a little more seriously on Saturday. So those are some of the lessons that we've learned through that experience.
Do you experience a lot of guys playing on multiple teams out there?
We do. Yeah, we do. We're kind of set up in a tiered way here where, you know, in Connecticut our all-star team is called the Liberty. You know, they travel to Maine, Bethpage, all the big ones, Gettysburg. You know, from there you get into the Bulldogs, which is a travel team. Goes pretty far, probably not as far as the Liberty. And then the remaining teams in the Connecticut Association play primarily in-state. So you have that great marriage of, hey, you know, Jimmy from Thames loves to travel, and they're off that day because that's how we schedule so that we have that ability to grab players. And, yeah, we'll absolutely share resources. And you have guys like myself and Jeff Kornhaus who are just baseball fiends. You know, we'll play for every team. I'm going to play every weekend next year. You know, I hope to play 50 games next year. So, you know, you tend to amass a lot of stuff. You know, I have a lot of uniforms and, you know, different artifacts and, you know, resources that we acquire through our vendors. So you become somewhat of a collector, not just of, you know, personal physical items, but really people and relationships and friendships. So there's really a lot there that is fun and rewarding and really drives people.
Do you guys get together, forgive me if this sounds like a dumb question, but do you get together with the other teams after the matches in a picnic situation?
We tend to go to a restaurant together. Most of our fields have an establishment nearby. I mean, right in Hartford, we have a wonderful brewery. I won't name drop them here because that's, you know, not here to free advertise for anyone. But yeah, it's kind of a unique thing to be able to have a brew pub, you know, and walking distance from your outfield. So I think that's a draw. I think a lot of teams that come to Connecticut enjoy that aspect of it. And, you know, we like getting off the field and talking to guys because, you know, sometimes you could have a close play or, you know, some consternation about, you know, whether it's a rule or someone's approach to the game or the result of a play or a game where, you know, sometimes in the field, you know, it can be very uncomfortable. And when you all get together afterwards, you start to learn more about the other people and, you know, the things that the aspects of vintage baseball that are important to us in the moment sometimes really aren't as important in the sense that we wouldn't, you know, enjoy time with people or, you know, grow our relationships or friendships. So you definitely see both ends of the way that people interact through baseball.
So you must have your favorite clubs that you look forward to seeing. With the CTVBBA, you have, is that five or six clubs that are in that?
Well, it's going to be six because we're trying to bring back the Newtown Sandy Hooks this season, who have been inactive for a number of years in a limited capacity. We're probably going to do two dates, but it would be nice to put them back on the map because I know a lot of work went into the original Sandy Hook team.
So you probably see, well, the other four clubs, you probably see them quite a bit. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when I don't play for them, I umpire them, you know, or just show up sometimes and enjoy a game.
So what clubs would you say that you don't get the chance to play very often, but you do get to play, that you really look forward to playing against?
I would say the two of the three teams that are in the Delaware County region of eastern New York, the Bovina Dairymen and the Mountain Athletic Club in Fleischmann's, are wonderful organizations, well-run, highly skilled, great ground, fun to be around. You know, it's just the big deterrent there is trying to get guys to go 3.5 hours up into the mountains. I don't mind doing it. I drop everything to go up to Fleischmann's, but that's difficult. So, yeah, I would say they are two of the teams that I really sincerely enjoy seeing who, yeah, just because of the physical, you know, limitations, we don't get to see as often as we would like to.
Okay, I just got a question from Corky Gaskell from Minnesota. I assume you've heard of Corky.
Sure.
And we covered this a little bit, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Maybe you'll throw something else in there. He wants to know your take on the issues of playing two different years of baseball that are, and he didn't say, but I'm assuming he's kind of far apart. When you're actually playing, you're playing 64 and you're playing 86. How hard is that transition as a player?
It's tricky. I mean, we have a lot of players who are, you know, in the younger stages of their vintage baseball career who are still learning a great deal. So we try to stay on top of, you know, lingo and accuracy. Like, you know, for instance, you wouldn't say her in 1864 because that was a much later term. You know, just like hands become out. You know, so we try to keep them honest on the terminology. Just so we're putting on a good performance for the fans, not just in the physical action, but the way that we interact and the way that we refer to the game accounts. That's tricky. You know, the various nuanced rules, like, you know, the one bound being an out in 64. If you're coming off an 86 game, a lot of times, you know, someone might mistakenly try to throw over to first base, you know, even though the out's already been recorded. You know, if you have a runner on base, that can become problematic, you know, depth that can start to advance. That's one example. You know, you see guys pull up and not run through first base sometimes in 86 if they're coming off of 64 games. So, yeah, I would say there's a myriad of potential pitfalls there. You know, it's through exposure and experience and education that I think guys become a little more adept at going between those two eras.
You know, I marvel at how much baseball you play. How old are you, Chuck?
I turned 40 this past June.
Do it while you can. I have a friend.
I mean,
go ahead.
No, I mean, there are times that I wish that I played more baseball. my mom passed away in March of 2015, right when we were kind of getting geared up for our spring training. And, you know, just because of the depth of my sadness for losing my mom, I didn't play in 2015. I wish I had. I just wasn't emotionally equipped to be able to do that at that point in time. So, you know, those are the healthy years that sometimes life, you know, changes your motivation or your desires. You know, I had a knee injury in 2018, halfway through the first Bulldog season. I tore my meniscus playing in a 64 game up at the farm in Newburyport with the Essex Baseball Organization. And that put me on the shelf. You know, I'm a year and a half out from my knee surgery, and I'm still trying to get a lot of my speed and agility back, and, you know, my load bearing, just, you know, my ability to be explosive off of my right leg. And, you know, it's after the dawn of the onset of time that, you know, you start to realize how fleeting baseball can be. So, yeah, you hate to lose a healthy year, but, you know, it just wasn't in the cards for me to play in 15 after the last bump.
But at least you can you know, substitute some of that lack of playing time with all the other captaining and organizations you're involved in. I'm assuming even though you weren't playing when you were injured, you were still heavily involved, probably umpiring, correct?
Heavily involved, yeah. A lot of umpiring, A lot of social influencing. I put a lot of my, you know, my visual creativity, you know, the way that I express myself professionally, into vintage baseball. So I make, you know, posters and, you know, different modes of notifying people of game events and accounts, you know, on social media platforms. But it was hard, you know, it was tough to be out there and not be in between the lines with my guys, especially when things weren't going our way. And, you know, maybe under different circumstances, I'd be able to help out. So yeah, that was tremendously challenging. But, you know, to your point, I did learn a great deal about how to be more effective at managing baseball just by being off the field. It really allowed me the time to see things from a different perspective and kind of get deeper into my thoughts on ways that I could make my team and our organization function more fluidly. So I guess, you know, in retrospect, I'm really grateful for that time.
I just got another question from Rudy Frias, the captain of the Columbus, Ohio Capitals.
Yes.
Rudy is actually the producer of this podcast, but when I'm doing phone interviews, he's not. He produces the live events that we're going to be doing. But his question for you is, he wants to know what your favorite memory thus far is in your vintage baseball experience.
Oh, man. What a question. Favorite memory. Oh, gosh.
Don't you hate it when you get asked a question and you have to pinpoint it down? I hate that, and I'm not going to do that to you. Here's what
I'm
going to do.
I'm going to answer the question.
All right, go ahead.
It's actually really recent. So this was this past July with Hattiesburg for the first time, playing for the Connecticut Liberty, who've been down there several times. We were in a baseball game where we were down by several runs. I think we were chasing 7 or 8 runs going into the ninth inning. And we chipped away. And lo and behold, I wound up with the bat in my hand with a couple runners on base and 2 outs in the last of our half of the ninth. And I just put my bat out there on a pitch that I liked. I think it was maybe the 4th or 5th pitch of the at bat. And I hit a ball real hard and drove in the game tying run. Didn't realize it. I was just so locked in on trying to get the ball out of the infield. Still recovering from the knee. Hot day, as it always is, I'm sure, in Gettysburg, you know, when it's not raining. We've got a steam that day. Get down to first base, and my captain, Brett, came up to me and said, well, we're going to pinch run you for obvious reasons. I said, sure thing. Started chugging off the base path, and he said to me, how does it feel? How did it feel to knock in the game-tying run? I said, wow, well, that's really something. So we ended, you know, after 9 innings, you know, in a tie. That was the 10th inning, and the first batter doubled, and the guy right after him doubled, and we won the baseball game. It was just a great moment for us. You know, like, when things are going your way on the baseball field, you just feel it, you know it.
Oh, sure.
Just like when things aren't going your way, you're doomed, it's just not your day, and you can feel it. There was something about going into that 9th inning, looking in these guys' eyes, and just knowing we were going to win the ball game. We weren't afraid of losing. We didn't think we were going to lose. We believed in ourselves. We believed in one another. And it was a real galvanizing moment, you know, for us as a Connecticut All-Star team.
That's great. While we're in that same frame of mind, I want to ask you, what was your favorite off-the-field vintage baseball memory, or one of your favorite, one of your favorite vintage baseball memories that happened off the field?
Oh, man, gosh, that's another good question. Off the field with vintage baseball. This past October, we had our second New Englander. What do we call it? We call it the Northeast All-Star Game because we have a lot of states represented now. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great if, the night before the game, the game's typically on a Sunday, if on Saturday night, you know, we all went downtown to Hartford to have a couple beers together and we could all wear, you know, our baseball jerseys. And it was all the people who showed up. We took great pictures. We had a full load of fun. Ed Elmo was there. I got to sit down with Ed and talk to him for hours. Just got really deep into his life in baseball and what his goals were and his feelings about where the game is now. That was a great night. You know, and then we went on to have a fabulous event the following day. But that night was a wonderful time on the field.
That is awesome. I just got another question. People really want to talk to you, Chuck. I got a question here from Jeremy Stedry, who's the long fielder for the Bay City, Michigan Independents. And it is, what is the overall perception of how Midwest plays compared to the East Coast?
The overall, my perception or my perception?
I think he's looking for overall perception.
I mean, you know, I try not to worry about teams outside of my, jurisdiction. We have a lot of work to do here in Connecticut. Just like every club, we don't do things perfectly. You know, the research is an ongoing process. We're blessed to have had so many leaders over the, last couple of generations, really, in this sport who, it was a lot harder for the guys in the, early 1980s to conduct, primary research, but they did. And that's all out there. You know, Ed Elmore has four books he was kind enough to give to me that lays out baseball from 1850 through the turn of the century. You know, I've had many great conversations with my friend Paul Salamone, who's a historian. We have the historical accuracy page on Facebook that I created really with Paul Salamone and Jake Newcomb several years ago. And to watch the way that page has exploded, the amount of work and research information, and discussions that people, volunteer and share and engage one another, it kind of opens my eyes that, Connecticut's not perfect. New England isn't perfect, just like I'm sure other regions might have their difficulties. But, I'd be remiss if I cast any sort of aspersion on any other region because I realize how challenging it is to do what we're trying to do. So I give those people a lot of credit, not just in the Midwest, but really all around the country for, dedicating their time to this very, very worthwhile pursuit.
Wow, what a great politically correct answer. Chuck, staying out of the fire. Okay, let me rephrase the question. You've played at Gettysburg, right?
I did.
And when somebody from the East Coast plays a team from the Midwest, what is their very first thought in their head?
First thing is just, wow, this is cool, to look around and see the different uniforms and the different clubs. I mean, it was really moving. To be on those fields, those grounds. My first impression was, man, I wish we could do something to this magnitude. I mean, we have our festivals in New England and New York. They're all very, very good. I wouldn't want to discredit any of them, but I was really impressed with the layout of Gettysburg. The imperfections of the field, for instance, they're not level, but that's fine. It would be a stretch to think that in 1863, we'd have manicured level grounds and everything's up to spec, because that just doesn't seem realistic. So, I think you have to embrace the imperfections, not just of the grounds, but all of us. We're all people. We're all doing our best. But I was just thrilled to be able to put names to faces. I mean, I saw people in person who I'd interacted with on Facebook, through the various groups dozens of times, and to see them in the flesh and to be able to look into their eyes and shake their hand and say, it is so nice to meet you, even though you feel like you've, lived with them for years, because, social media and technology has made everything so much smaller for all of us. And that's a wonderful thing, but it's not without its perils either. Sometimes people and teams suffer from intimacy, right? When you become too familiar with someone and their perspective that you, might not agree with. That sure. Can become a difficult thing. Reading people's ideas in text, right? Text always reads a little angrier.
Everybody people... reads my texts angry. I don't get it. I'm not a good texter. But the social media.
That's the nature of the beast, right? When we read something that we disagree with, our interior monologue has those words sounding much more seething at times, right?
Sure.
But I don't think for a moment that anybody who invests their time and passion into historical accuracy in 19th century baseball has an ill motivation. I think they're all great people who care about the project. We wouldn't do this if that's what it was. If this was an animosity or vitriol-filled experience, people wouldn't want to do it. As leaders and captains in our regions, it's our responsibility to create an environment people want to gravitate toward, because that's the future of our game. Nobody's going to be playing this game in 20 years if we spend all of our time, casting aspersions on other areas or shooting barbs at each other. You know, none of us are on a mountaintop. We're all equal partners in this, from my perspective. So, yeah, my impression is that it's great to be at Gettysburg. I wish we could do more things like that, you know, but it's difficult and costly and time-consuming. But the ones that we do get to go to, you know, my main motivation is just getting to know some people and finding out what drives them. You know, what is it about different people from different regions that what makes their motor run? Is there something there, some juice or some magic potion that I can fill a bottle of and you know, revamp my approach? Or, you know, if I do something wrong that turns a player off, you know, how can I be better in the future so that I can take a corrective action, if you will, for a matter of accuracy or, you know, sportsmanship or composure in a way that builds the person up and makes them still want to be part of the experience.
Very well said. I knew there was a reason why you were the first person I wanted to interview on the phone.
Thank you very much.
It was, you know, I released my first episode on Christmas Eve with a local player by the name of Mike Marbles Feeney, who's the captain of the Canton Corn Shuckers, and they just won the World's Tournament that happens at Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan every year.
Very good.
That's our big thing in this area. So I knew I had to start with him. He's one of the most loved local vintage baseball players. You got to come out strong. And then I knew when I was going to do a phone interview, I had to do somebody that everybody was going to be interested in, and your name came up. So,
geez, thank you very much. No, I'm thrilled to do this. Thank you for asking.
And hopefully you and I meet someday. Actually, that would be great.
I certainly hope so.
I feel like I know you just from social media, like you were talking about. I know some stuff about you.
Yeah, I mean, look, when Black Bart walked onto the field at Gettysburg, and I was picking my job off the ground, I said, "Here's this guy. I've been dying to meet this guy." And I walked off to him, and just a big handshake and just a big warm smile. And, you know, those are the experiences. It's not a bunch of, or it shouldn't be, a bunch of dissatisfied people looking out the window in February because it's cold or the ground's frozen and we're bored and angry about it. Now we're going to deflect our dissatisfaction on someone who might do something different from us, right? That's no fun. But that comes with it, right? That's part of the price of admission when you're in these social groups, is that you are going to be exposed to both, you know, both ends of the spectrum. And that's been a big, you know, learning experience for me. You know, it wasn't too many years ago that I'd come out guns blazing in a baseball, you know, conversation that would escalate into an argument. We see it happen all the time. There was one recently on Facebook where a couple of guys got into a big dispute about a baseball bat or the specs of a baseball bat. Then it escalated to the point where I was genuinely concerned about both of these men being together at the All-Star game in Connecticut, which is where they should be because they belong there on every imaginable level of baseball. And when they met that night I was referring to downtown Hartford, it was like none of it ever happened. And now they're laughing, having a beer together, sharing stories, because that's the reality. Nobody wants to fight anybody. You know, it's about meeting people and doing that outreach. But to see those two people, that, I mean, it was going in a bad direction in a New York minute. And the second they laid eyes on each other and realized that they're a lot more similar than they are different, that was really a bright moment for our entire event.
And thanks to social media, I know the exact two people you're talking about.
Of course.
And I saw the exact conversation. So
how could you not? It was appointment reading.
Yes, and I was happy to see pictures of the war not actually happening. So
there's a great picture from the All-Star game. I'll have to send it to you. I think it's Ian has his arm around Jeff, and they're walking away from the camera and having a conversation. I think there's a bat over one of their shoulders, and that was the defining image of the season for me. See those two men who are extremely talented and knowledgeable baseball guys, you know, come together after a moment of discord and really share an experience the way they did.
Yeah, absolutely. Send me that picture. I'll actually use that picture as one of the pictures to promote your episode. I see.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, make sure you get it.
I see that you guys are releasing your schedule on January 20th. Is that your team individually, or is that all six of yous together?
That's going to be that's going to be the master schedule for all six teams. So we have a conference on the 18th. We're getting all the players together at Connecticut College. We're going to go through the schedule. We're going to have every team, you know, have the floor, talk about their goals and, you know, the state of the union insofar as their clubs. We're going to talk about umpiring, the importance of umpiring, you know, just how to be the best we can be in all phases of this game. And then after we give the players a chance to have eyes in the schedule, you know, we'll answer questions. And if there's an adjustment that needs to be made, we'll make it together. But I thought it would be a great idea for us to come together, you know, as a state before we release the schedule publicly.
Wow, that is a great idea. I like that a lot. You can go to, I believe, I got it right here, the website is ctvbba.org. You can find out all about the clubs. You can find out about past clubs that have been in it. You got a lot of information on here. Are you involved in the website?
Our website is run by Michael Drymiller. He's the captain of the Thames Baseball Club in New London, and he does a great job. He puts a lot of work into it. If we ask him to add or adjust or subtract something, he always does. He always finds time for us. Mike's one of those resources, like the rest of the leaders of Connecticut, who, you know, he really goes above and beyond to help us out. So, you know, after the schedule gets released, the website will be populated with that. You know, primarily that will be the Topkins post, if you will. And then as the season progresses, we're really interested. We have a lot of young, aspiring journalists. I want to say the Providence Braves do a tremendously good job with their sports writing. You know, to be able to have a real detailed game account in an unbiased way with a focus on historical accuracy, they for me set the high water mark. So in a perfect world, if we were to do that, I'd want to be like the Braves in a lot of ways. It's going to take a lot of work, you know. It's not just, hey, play the game and then go home, hit the showers and go back to real life. Like, if we're going to do this, you know, we need to commit that time to make the sports writing, you know, high quality that people, you know, want to visit. Give them a reason to come back to our website. So you'll see more content, hopefully, as the season progresses.
But Connecticut's like the capital of newspaper writers, isn't it? Something like that? Like,
I'm not sure. I'd have to check
I think
that
there's
out.
More, or at, well, at the peak, more sports writers in Connecticut than any other state.
Okay. Well, you know, having the mothership here probably helps with that.
Yes, the mothership. We had a vintage baseball tournament on ESPN Plus or 3. ESPN 3. It was live, the live streaming.
Oh, okay.
We did that last June in Frankenmuth at the thing that I do. So we got a huge number in the audience. It shows that people are very interested. It's an eye-catcher.
Yeah, and I think, you know, more awareness is gonna whet that appetite. You know, again, I sincerely believe that nobody knows we exist. I don't even mean that as a joke. I mean,
no, I say it all the time.
I could drop you in the middle of anywhere USA, and you could say vintage baseball, and you may as well be speaking, you know, in tongues. People just don't know about it. So hopefully, you know, through our combined efforts and all these various things we do, we'll start to stem the tide there a little bit.
Oh yeah, no, I absolutely agree that nobody knows we exist, and you know, I often say that the statistic of how humans only use 10% of their brain applies to vintage baseball, how only 10% of the people know we exist. But then I found out that stat about the brain, that's not real. So,
oh really?
I can't use that. It's just an urban legend that people use all of their brains. It was just a thing that got started.
All of their brains?
You use all of your brain. Your brain is being used. You're not only using 10% of it.
But, you know, it's the biggest thing that I want to get across as far as Connecticut goes and our place in the vintage baseball world is, you know, we want to be a destination. You know, we have special events that I know people come to. We want to continue that trend and provide more events for people to enjoy. But we also want to be a bridge state. So if, say, a New York team was heading up to Boston to play, I don't know, the Bean Eaters on a Saturday, we'd like them to stop by on Sunday and hit us on the way back. And that happens. You know, we see the Mutuals and the Atlantics and the Eckbirds and, you know, a lot of quality clubs out of that Long Island pocket. And it's not just exclusively them. It could be any of the teams in New Jersey or anywhere that's traveled to Boston. I mean, heck, come see us. see us on the way back. We'll show you a great time. We'll play great baseball with you on some of the best fields we have. We'll take you out, show you a nice meal and a good time, because that's how we like to do it.
Absolutely. Chuck, can you tell me, I was looking on your, you can find Chuck Chicarello on, you can find him on the Facebooks if you want to start a relationship social media wise with him. And one of your pictures, oh, here it is right here. It's you and Jeff. There is a pie with the Weathersfield Red Onion logo on it. What kind of pie is that?
That was a cheesecake. Jeff, the wonderful person, his dad made these great cheesecakes every year on Christmas. And, you know, in his age and weakened condition, he's yet to stop doing that. So Jeff has taken on this tradition now where he doesn't just make one or two. He makes dozens of cheesecakes. And he came to my house on Christmas Eve, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. As, you know, my family was getting ready to go to church and that sort of thing. And he had this cheesecake in his hand. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, the holidays are a really tough time for me. I miss my mom tremendously. And, you know, and the joy that I get from vintage baseball really filled that void in my life in ways that I never, ever would have expected it to. So I was feeling quite upset personally on Christmas Eve. And, you know, you might be able to see in my face, I'm a little puffy and my eyes are a little watery. But, you know, here comes Jeff up my driveway with this amazing cheesecake. And, you know, he brightened my day. And I wasn't the only person. He went around all around Connecticut. He comes from Danbury, Connecticut. He drove over an hour diagonally northeast through Connecticut to come get me a cheesecake. And along the way, he stopped at a number of other people's houses with these distinctive cheesecakes. And that's just the kind of guy he is. You know, when I first came to Connecticut and I met Jeff, I said, here's a guy who's got it. He's got it. He knows how to make people want to do this. And he fast became my model for what it would mean to be an effective baseball leader. Just the endearing nature of who he is as a person and how much he really cares about people. It's not an act. He's not putting on airs to impress anyone. That's just the way he is. And that opened my eyes to baseball, you know, in a leadership capacity in profound ways to want to be like Jeff.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Jeff is a guy that is on our radar over here in the Midwest.
He finds his way up everyone's radar in one way or another.
Yes. Yes. So, great conversation, Chuck. Thank you so much. I'm going to end this show. I'm going to talk to you about some bizarre facts about Connecticut on our way out.
Okay.
And have a little fun with this, and then we'll say our goodbyes. I want to talk to you about this one right here, where in order for a pickle to be officially considered a pickle in Connecticut, it must bounce. Are you aware of this?
I was not aware of that, but I'm you know, it causes concern for the pickle, first and foremost. But then, you know, if it's fielded cleanly on one bound, is the striker retired or?
Well, this is actually a pickle. And if you throw it on the ground to find out if it bounces, I mean, you don't even get to enjoy the pickle.
Hopefully we're dropping these on clean surfaces.
The state insect in Connecticut, are you aware of what that is?
State insect in Connecticut. Oh boy, I'm not a big insect fan, I should tell you. I don't like arachnids either, but hit me. Wait, what is it?
It is the praying mantis.
Ooh.
This is disturbing on even worse than the pickle situation. You know, the praying mantises, the woman in the situation, don't they like tear the head off the male after mating?
I've heard that, but I also heard that we only use 10% of our brain, so now I don't know if I can trust anything I've ever been told.
Did you know that 78% of statistics are all made up on the spot?
Oh, I gotta jump in real quick with one thing. So I saw this great meme online. It was right around the time that we were going to Gettysburg, and it said, "Don't believe everything you read on Facebook. This is a quote with a picture next to it. Abraham Lincoln."
Yes. Yes. Oh. Okay. Do you live by Salisbury, Connecticut?
I don't. I've been to Salisbury, Massachusetts a lot. I don't think I've been to Salisbury, Connecticut.
In Salisbury, Connecticut, you might be interested to know, is the oldest public library in the United States.
Well, my wife's a librarian. I'm sure she's enjoyed learning that.
I look forward to telling her. 1771. Okay, and...
Yeah. Wait, to get there, do you have to be climbing up on Salisbury Hill?
I don't know. I was hoping you would
know. Cue the music! Cue the music!
I don't have the rights for that kind of nonsense. And our last fact that is... It's true. You can't cross the streets in Hartford, Connecticut, walking on your hands. It's illegal. You'll get ticketed.
Well, that's a challenge accepted, first of all. not that I'm going to be the one to do it, but I'll tell you what. Now that you brought that to my awareness, I think that it's incumbent upon us to have someone at some point walk across the street in Hartford, Connecticut, on their hands. Hopefully we won't get run in.
If there's a law, something happened. Laws don't just exist for no reason. So,
well, Jim Morrison also showed up in Connecticut that there are other things that you can't do.
Pull out your Google machines and type in
Jim Morrison
in Connecticut. All right, Chuck. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. People are really going to enjoy listening from you.
That's very nice of you, and I'm just overjoyed that you extended to me the opportunity to have this platform. I want to wish you and your group the best of luck in all your endeavors. It's because of the passion and energy and the care of people like you that this project is in the good place that it is.
Oh, thanks, Chuck. I appreciate that. And that's going to wrap up this episode. And after you listen to this one, a week later, you'll be able to download an episode with, who is it? It is Nick Too Far Sanders, the catcher of the Columbus, Ohio Capitals. You'll be able to download that episode next week. Thanks for everybody who downloaded this episode and listened. And you can find the Roller Out the Barrel podcast on all of the social media places. And we're also at strikewellgents.org. Thank you.